Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you guys so much for joining us. Got a really special guest with us today, not just Dory. This is a special guest, a guy that I've been following, and a guy that I think is talking about things that no one's paying enough attention to, and it falls right in line with you know, with the way that we're investing and a lot of our thoughts. And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Luke Grohman, the CEO and founder of Forest for the Trees Research. Luke, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Luke, give us a little bit of background. And I've been listening to your stuff and following you on Twitter and reading your research. Give us a little bit of background about, you know, where you came from, where you started from, a little bit of that trajectory in terms of your career and what led you to here.
Sure, absolutely. So I spent over 20 years on Wall Street, started off at a old line Cleveland money management firm called Ralston and Company that had a small sell side research business. So I started there in research and then was an early member of a team that formed Midwest Research in Cleveland, Ohio. And we were really pioneers in doing bottoms-up, survey-based fundamental research and moved from research to sales at that point. We ended up selling that business to First Tennessee Bank back in 2001, worked for FTM Midwest in sales. And then in 2006, a group of about 20 partners and myself split off and formed Cleveland Research Company, where we were, you know, continuing to do very in-depth, bottoms-up fundamental research. And in both the Midwest research seats and Cleveland research seats, I was an editor and founder of a weekly product that summarized our research findings. And then I also married that with a number of different macro and thematic information or data points that I was finding on my own time. And that piece became very popular, very widely read by thousands of people across Wall Street every Friday afternoon. Into the 2007-2008 timeframe, we really helped a number of customers of our firm position well for what was coming. We saw it well ahead of time. And so into that, and then post-2008, as the world became more macro and central bank driven, I was spending more of my time doing that. By 2013, wanted to pursue that role full time. My partners and I discussed that, and we just found that it, you know, my one caveat was I wanted to be able to have the creative control to write whatever I wanted to write, simply because I felt, and based on what I was seeing, that we were moving into an era where there are just a lot of things that, you know, we've not either seen in a very long time or ever in financial markets. And I felt like it would be important to have that kind of flexibility to my writing. So we agreed to part ways amicably. And so in early 2014, I hung out my own shingle as FFTT, stands for Forest for the Trees. And what we do is we, you know, I've got, you know, I tell people all the time, I've got the greatest job in the world. I read probably 5, 6, 7 hours a day. And I aggregate large amounts of publicly available data in a very unconventional manner, trying to identify developing economic bottlenecks in a variety of different sectors and from both a macro and sector standpoint, thematic standpoint. And so it's been, you know, we're going into year 5. The product's been very well received on Wall Street and among family offices and investors. And so it's been a really fun journey. It just keeps getting more exciting, it seems.
Yeah, well, it's we're hearing you and seeing you on more and more. Now, are you guys also a registered investment advisor, or do you actually manage money as well, or are you strictly on the research side of things?
Strictly on the research side. We are not an RIA.
No. Okay, gotcha. So one of the things that caught me about your research is I'm a few years behind you, but was starting my career out with Russell Investments in you know, mutual fund, Russell 2000. I know you're familiar with that.
Here
in the Seattle, Washington area. And yeah, I think I started with them 2004, 2005 out of college, finance degree, and just jumped into that job and watched that whole thing unravel, and then took a job as a broker. Anyway, long story short, watched this whole 08, 09 debacle happen. And I was raised in a broker dealer, and my grandfather was actually, several different New York Times best-selling books, and was a big dollar bear back in the '80s and the '70s and eighties, and in the explosion of gold back then. So I was kind of raised around this environment of, you know, rising debt and all that other kind of stuff that we're dealing with today, which in hindsight, you look back to everybody freaking out about the value of the dollar in the early '80s, you know, it's kind of a, you know, hold my beer scenario as far as debt and deficits have gone since then. You know, little did we all know, right? It could get so strange, but
sure.
One of the things that I remember watching and thinking, and that's really kind of been a central theme in the way that we manage money, is looking at this whole, QE and central bank experiment and thinking, you know, this can last as long as the value of the currencies is in a vacuum. If these things have to stand on their own merits, and currency, you know, valuations become an issue, this whole thing falls apart. What got you? I love how specialized you are and how focused you are on this. Do you see this currency issue as the linchpin to everything? And then, if so, how did you come to that? Where did that start, you know, bleeding into your conscience and making you sit there and go, wait a second, you know, this is really where we should be focused?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I do think it is, if not the linchpin, I would say it's definitely a key linchpin. You know, but it's one of these things, right? If you asked a fish to describe its environment, the very last thing it would list would be the water. And you know, the currency situation is a little bit like that, right? Where the way we started thinking about it really probably started back in early 2009. Both for our customers and even my personal accounts, it was very well positioned for that. Was sitting mostly in cash in by March of 09 in my personal accounts. And I'll never forget, you know, when they sort of did the big QE where they, you know, and I remember taking a step back and going, oh my gosh, I think they're just printing money out of thin air and buying debt. And, you know, and so that was sort of not on the playbook of really anybody on Wall Street at that point that could be done. I wouldn't say anybody, but the vast majority. And so, of course, I did what a lot of people, I think, you know, kind of do, right? You're like, oh, gosh, they're printing money. Well, what's the first thing that most Americans think of when they think of people printing money is they think of, you know, Weimar Germany in the 20s. And so, of course, I went home that night and, you know, ordered up a book on Amazon. And started reading that, and you quickly realize if you be objective about it that yes, they're both printing money in a way, but it's not exactly that simple, and there are a lot of differences and political, both domestic and external politics factor in heavily into it, and you know, what's the reserve status of the currency and things like that. And so you start trying to break it down. But the overriding theme for me was an economic system in which one party is creating money out of thin air to exchange it for real goods from another party cannot be sustainable unless the party exchanging the goods is stupid. And right. We know for a fact that the parties, you know, providing the goods aren't stupid. And so that leads you to a situation of, all right, this solution, quote unquote solution that was being offered can't be sustainable. So then it comes down to, all right, if it's not sustainable, you know, how long do we have? What will it look like as it develops? What, you know, what happens when it breaks down? What will the symptoms be if we're starting to see it break down? And so that was really, I think, where, you know, I kind of started thinking about that. It was just really this intuitive, you know, understanding of money that, yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Right. I was laughing because I remember the way I came to be focused on this and interested in it, in researching it, was exactly the same way. I remember, and I'm not embarrassed to admit this, I remember the day that they announced quantitative easing, I'm sitting there looking around my office going, what is that? I didn't even know what it was. And it caught me off guard. I felt like I should know what this is. And I'd never even heard the term. It kind of came out of thin air. Anyway, now I want to jump around and really get back to the dollar, because I've gotten notes here. I've been more excited to talk to you about this than probably no knock on our other guests, but excited to pick your head about this whole dollar situation. And for those of you just joining us, we're talking to Luke Grohman, CEO and founder of Forest for the Trees. He can go to your website at www.fftt.com. Is that it?
It's fftt-llc.com.
Okay. And I would encourage you guys to go read his research. I don't want to make you blush here, Luke, but you kind of turned into the, it probably wasn't your intention, but you've kind of turned into the pseudo dollar expert here. And I've just found your thoughts and your arguments really, really compelling. Want to get into the looking at the dollar in general. Where do we go from here? Now this is a topic, obviously, we could shoot in about 20 different directions at the same time, but you know, I'm not so much focused on the short term moves. When we look at the stimulus the fiscal stimulus bill that Trump, and I can't see him not passing it, we start looking at the budget deficits. Where do we go from here? I can't imagine the dollar going into free fall as it's, you know, as we sit right now. But what is the trajectory on from where you sit, from the research you're doing? Where are we at in terms of dollar valuations and being the reserve currency of the world? Big question. I get that. But just kind of give us a synopsis of where you see, you know, where we're at in that journey and you know, what we're looking at here.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I would probably answer that by taking a step back. And, you know, people often say, well, these types of monetary transitions take decades. And we completely agree with that. We think it's important to properly date the start of said monetary transitions, though. And so, you know, we would highlight, you know, a big moment, we think, was back in 1999 with the founding or the launch of the euro. You know, when they launched it, you know, the Europeans put 15% of Eurozone reserves into physical gold, mark to market quarterly. And so they basically made the euro a pro-cyclical currency with gold, which is a really curious thing to do, right? Is I think generally, you know, general narrative about Europe and the U.S. is that, you know, they love the dollar. And the reality, I think, is as with anything, it's more shades of gray than black and white. And you know, I take a step back and I always try to watch what they do and weight that more than what they say. And when I think about that in terms of where we are with the dollar, look, if the Europeans were so happy with the dollar and the system the way it stood, why would they ever put the anti-dollar as 15% of their reserves, mark to market quarterly, to make it pro-cyclical with the anti-dollar? You know, unless there was something they were seeing at that point, right? I mean, it's yes, these transitions take decades. What I always say is, you know, that was 1999. So we're almost two decades in already, at least. And the reality is the Europeans were talking about a pan-European currency as far back as the 60s because they were unhappy with the dollar. And so you're really, you know, arguably as much as five decades in. So that was, you know, 99 with the launch of the euro, I think, was the first big moment. I think 08 was the second big moment where, look, the world got to see, you know, that when push comes to shove, the U.S. will print money. If it comes to the U.S.'s domestic economic situation or the maintenance of the value of the dollar as the world's reserve currency, you know, America came first.
Right.
We printed the money.
Right.
And so that was another big milestone. And then I think, you know, the last big milestone, you know, we've also highlighted in at the end of 2013, China, People's Bank of China came out and publicly announced that it was no longer in China's interest to stockpile FX reserves, which is, you know, which are, you know, two thirds roughly U.S. treasuries. It was no longer in their interest to stockpile FX reserves anymore. That was a huge moment. That was them beginning to kind of walk away. And then in the third quarter of 2014 was really, I think, the moment where things started to get hot and heavy in terms of this monetary transition. That was the quarter when global central bank FX reserves, right? So these are, the way to think about these are basically if a nation exports more than it imports, it ends up with a surplus, and it uses some portion of that surplus and reinvests them into, you know, reserve assets, sovereign debt, heavily U.S. dollar denominated. At any rate, these FX reserve balances had risen every year without fail for 70 years up to 3Q14, and they began falling for the first time in 70 years.
Wow.
And what this basically means is, yeah, it was a huge moment. It was very largely ignored by most investors. And what this began to do was effectively, what it meant was that, you know, for the first time in 70 years, U.S. deficits matter. I mean, earlier in the program, you mentioned, you know, back in the 80s, you know, we didn't know how much deficits could keep growing. Well, you know, Dick Cheney famously said in 2004, you know, reportedly that, hey, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. And Cheney was absolutely right. Well, as intellectually offensive as that may be for some people, he was right.
Yeah.
But he was only right for as long as global central banks would keep stockpiling those FX reserves. And that stopped in the third quarter of 14. And, you know, that combined with another big event that quarter, which was the beginning acceleration of multi-currency oil pricing, right? The other side of the dollar reserve status has been its position as effectively the monopoly settlement currency for oil globally under the petrodollar. And in May of 14, Russia and China signed a holy grail gas or energy deal that was rumored to be denominated in yuan, at least partially, and later shown to be. And then in the third quarter of 14, China effectively began reopening the Bretton Woods gold window through yuan, a floating gold price, when they opened the Shanghai Gold Exchange International Board, where it became at least theoretically possible to exchange offshore yuan balances for physical gold in Shanghai. And so you began to, you know, these events all began to effectively make U.S. deficits matter again. And so I think that kind of, you know, we've seen the U.S. take a variety of steps to try to alleviate some of the pressures that caused. We began seeing LIBOR or offshore dollar borrowing rates rise bottom and begin rising in 3Q14, and they've been rising ever since. And that's sort of a temperature gauge of how much U.S. deficits are crowding out the dollar markets in the world. You know, quite frankly, I think last week was a huge moment in terms of where we are in the whole timeline, simply because, you know, we said in the past in some of our writing and to customers is, you know, in theory, one of the big signs or big symptoms we would see as this starts to get more critical or closer to a tipping point is in some big risk off scenario, you would expect to see at some point, instead of treasury bond yields falling with stocks in a risk off, you would see treasury yields either not fall or even rise in a big stock sell.
Right.
So it was very fascinating to us last week as we had one of the fastest 10% drops in the equity markets on record.
Right.
Long bond actually sold off with equities, which I thought was a very interesting set of affairs that was very unusual.
Yeah, I love that you I love that you talked about that because I've been thinking about that in the exact same way and noticed that. And there've been a couple other instances and I want to get to those. I also want to review a piece of research that you wrote that everybody can go to your website and get. It's in some of your samples. But anyway, we got to take a quick break. So for those of you that have just joined us midway through this or just joined us recently, stick with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with Luke Grohman and continue our conversation about the dollar. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Man, the stock market's really been on a wild ride. I'm so happy our retirement portfolio that Zach Abraham at Bulwark Capital Management built is specifically designed for volatility. Zach, stocks and bonds go down at the same time. How's that possible?
Dory, great question. We've been trying to warn people for a long time. Interest rates are at historic lows. They basically can only go up from here. As interest rates go up, bonds lose money regardless of what's going on in the stock market. You've got to have a different safety net in your portfolio other than bonds.
This is your retirement. Get a second opinion. Schedule a free risk review with Zach. He'll show you a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio compared to the strategy he would recommend. It's exactly how the Monsons became a client of Bulwark Capital. Call now. Schedule a risk review. Get your free copy of Common Sense Investing, 866-779-RISK, 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com. Bulwark Capital Management, a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Hey, this is Dory Monson. I'm here with Brian Ott from 525 Advisors, host of Long-Term Care Radio, right here on Cairo every Saturday morning at 7. And Brian, you have a class coming up in Bellevue, March 10th, a great way to learn about long-term care planning. What do you think is the one thing our listeners really need to know?
It's that the government doesn't pay for long-term care, Dory, and there's really only two ways to pay for care. One is to self-fund and watch everything you've worked hard for get whittled down by the high cost of care, or the second way is to protect your savings and your family by setting up a long-term care plan.
Which is exactly what my wife and I did with Brian. I encourage you to do the same. Sign up for Brian's next class, March 10th. Learn how you can protect your savings and the people you care about the most with the newest programs, including plans that pay you back if you never use them. Sign up at 525longtermcare.com. That's 525longtermcare.com. And you can always learn more by tuning in every Saturday morning at 7 for Long-Term Care Radio here on Cairo.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us. And if you just joined us, we are having a conversation with Luke Grohman, the Chief Investment Officer and Founder and CEO, all the hats, at Forest for the Trees Research. And Luke is, you kind of got a global schedule these days. You're in high demand for as a speaker on this topic. And shoot, you were just in Barbados last week, right?
I was, yes, which was pretty good as far as speaking gigs go for this time of year when you're from Cleveland, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's not too much different here in Seattle. a little colder though, a little colder where you guys are at.
Yeah, we get about the same amount of cloudiness. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You start feeling like a vampire around February and you got to go get some sun. Okay. I want to get into this piece cause I was fascinated about what you said and I want to tie this together. And if I seem a little disjointed, it's cause I've got about 3 hours worth of questions that I'm going to try to fit in here. But I would encourage everybody to go to the website, www.fftt-llc.com. That's Luke's website. And look at his free research. And if you're out there and do this for a living, I'm sure Luke wouldn't mind if you became a paying customer, which perhaps off-air or over email, we can talk about that. Because I think that that's going to be something that we're definitely going to try to take advantage of. But a really interesting piece of research you put out, which is something that I've kind of been toying with and a theory that I've been running around in my head for quite a while, that when you look at the historically low rate of growth that we've had in the U.S. economy over the last 10 years, it's right at or slightly slower than the Great Depression, and yet we've seen this meteoric rise in asset prices, you know, real estate, bonds, stocks, everything. And one of the things that I've kind of toyed with in my head, you know, thinking about is, maybe these last 8 or 9 years have been more of a central bank repricing of assets, and that, you know, perhaps when we get real growth or quote unquote real inflation actually coming into the system, we'll see another leg up. And now, don't get me wrong, we're a value shop, so we're fit to be tied right now. I hear other people claim that stocks aren't expensive, and I just. You know, it's kind of one of those where I'll take what he's drinking because obviously he's having quite an effect. But you put in here and it really caught my eye when I was doing show prep was it was a piece you put out March 30th of 2017. And you talked about instead begin considering U.S. stock valuation in the context that any drop in stocks will accelerate the need for either a U.S. Treasury nominal default or a U.S. dollar devaluation or helicopter money. So what I'm wondering is, in this world, the way I look at it, and I want you to, you know, answer the question, obviously, however you can, but also don't be shy about critiquing me, because I, you know, I'm doing this for the audience, but I did it to pick your brain as well. But one of the things that I've been looking at is our worry about a deflationary scare right now ridiculous? Because the Fed's all in. You know, everybody is, you know, worrying about, is this going to happen? You know, when you run a balance sheet up to $4.5 trillion, what's another $2 or $3 trillion, right? I mean, it's all funny money at this point. Should we be worried about a traditional collapse in risk assets in the way that we've seen them in the past? Or is that us, you know, are we having a hard time readjusting? Are they even going to let that happen? Is that even possible?
It's not that it can't happen. Obviously, as we saw last week, with a little downdraft. But what we were really talking about in that piece is when you start to, when you take a step back, and the short answer is it can happen, but it cannot be allowed to last for very long before it begins to threaten the solvency of the U.S. government. By that, I mean U.S. policymakers have, over the last 25, 30 years in particular, but really probably back at least 50 years, have set up a series of policies, accelerating policies, that effectively have increasingly made the U.S. economy increasingly dependent on rising asset prices, rising debt levels, falling interest rates, and not on sort of, you know, production and manufacturing, which is tends to be less cyclical, more, you know, can kind of cushion things. And so because it has gotten to the point where it is, I mean, the stock market's valuation is now, what, 150% of GDP, and you've got federal debt over 100% of GDP, and rates are at, you know, still near 5,000-year lows, you're sort of out of wiggle room to the standpoint where a significant, persistent, sustained drop in risk assets quickly begins to negatively impact tax receipts through not just capital gains and through IRA distributions, but also through, you know, if you look at the wage growth, you know, there's been much written about wage and income and wealth discrepancy in this country, and, you know, how 5%, the top 5%, you know, they now pay 60% of the individual income taxes because, you know, they're making about that, you know, about that much of the income. But if you look at where that's coming from, a lot of those are executives that are getting paid on restricted stock and incentive comp and options, which are all tied to the stock market as well. And so you've really set up this economy through policy decisions of the last 25 years that have become heavily dependent on ever rising prices, on low volatility. And if they don't, it increasingly, given the amount and the leverage involved, begins to pose a fiscal problem for the U.S. government. And so that was our point in looking at that in that report, where, you know, we got into that report, and, you know, what really triggered us to write that report was right around that time last year. Warren Buffett came out and publicly said that, you know, stocks did not appear to be in a bubble if you took into account interest rates. And it left me scratching my head because, as you can see in that report, you know, based on the Warren Buffett, what's come to be known as the Warren Buffett metric, which is equity market cap as a percent of GDP, it was already trading at a level where, 17 years prior in 1999 or 18 years prior in 1999. Buffett had called stocks a bubble. Yet here we were trading at the same, you know, Warren Buffett metric multiple as a percent of market cap to GDP. And this time he was saying it wasn't if we took interest rates into consideration. And so I began to sort of tinker around with what was different. And if you look at, you know, if you adjust equity market cap for the value of U.S. federal debt, you know, stocks do begin to look cheap, because if you consider how important stocks are to actually the sustainability of that debt load. You know, it's intellectually offensive circular logic, but it's, you know, that's sort of, you know, that's like government math for you, unfortunately. So to directly answer your question, I would never say we can't have a risk sell-off, but I think if you had a significant risk sell-off that persisted for longer than days, weeks, maybe a couple months at a time, you're quickly going to bring in a very big fiscal problem for the U.S. government that is going to require, you know, either a big dollar devaluation, a renewal of very big Fed QE, or a default by the U.S., a nominal default by the U.S. government, either internally on entitlements. In other words, sorry, we're not paying your Medicare or Social Security bills the way we used to, or, you know, sorry, foreign creditors, we're not making the interest payments on treasuries for the next couple months.
Right. Well, and for those of you just joining us, we're talking to the CEO, CIO, and founder of Forest for the Trees Research, Luke Grohmann. And Luke, just going off of that, and expanding on that thought a little bit, I'm not sure if you're the first one that said it, but I just thought it was perfect terminology where we talked about deficits not mattering and, you know, other governments, other central banks sterilizing our deficits for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, possibly even longer than that. I'm sure you'd know the exact dates. But in that scenario, isn't that kind of what QE is? Isn't it sort of the Fed sterilizing you know, the deficits for us? And what is to prevent them? You know, when we talk about things like nominal default, you know, I get what you're talking about because you're referring to math. and that it seems like math and logic is becoming less and less important the further down this rabbit hole we go. But what is to stop the Fed from stepping in where China and Japan or, you know, our external financiers, where they pull back and they're quit, you know, they're no longer willing to sterilize those deficits. Hasn't that sort of been what the Fed's been doing already? And what's to stop them from keep doing that, from continuing that?
Yeah, I think there's very little to stop them from continuing that. And it's, yeah, effectively that is what it is. If you look at, you know, sort of when it came in and the deficits blew out and you had sort of the shortfall, it's not direct financing. You know, the classically trained economists would say, well, they're not directly financing it, you know, from one pocket to the other. You know, it's going into the markets first. So it's okay. It's not quote unquote helicopter money. And they're right. Wall Street makes a commission coming and going when they use a third party to do this stuff. But there's very little to stop them from doing that. And I think it's interesting that, you know, I mentioned before that once, you know, global central banks stopped, you know, growing their FX reserves, stopped sterilizing our deficits in 3Q14, you know, it's a lot of people tell you, well, the Fed tape began tapering, or they finished tapering then. They've been tightening since. And, you know, it's interesting. Once deficits start mattering for the U.S. again, or started mattering again, you know, we sort of become, you know, a version of sort of like every other country on the planet has always been, where deficits matter. And if you start looking at some of the things that have transpired, forced by regulators, including the Fed, since then, you know, it starts to look, some of the actions are things that emerging markets that are running into balance of payments problems start to do. So, for example, in the third quarter of 14, as FX reserve balances at central banks peaked, the Fed mandated that U.S. commercial banks had to own more treasuries under what were called high-quality liquid asset regulations, HQLA. And it was basically forced U.S. commercial banks via regulation to buy more treasuries. And that's a sort of a classic emerging market having a balance of payments problem move. And then you had, that was effectively, you know, it was certainly hundreds of billions of effective QE through the U.S. commercial banking system.
Hey, and Luke, if I can interrupt you, then, if I can interrupt you for a second, was this in a, and by the way, another thing that everybody should go listen to is that dollar special that you participated in on macrovoices.com. I thought that was outstanding. But is this the scenario you were talking about when and I'm forgetting what it was. I wished I would have listened to it again last night, but you talked about how it was either the IMF or somebody said, we're used to seeing these problems in third world economies, not in developed economies. Is that, do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was there was a great article written in I think it was Atlantic Magazine back in May of 2009 by the former chief economist of the IMF, and his name escapes me at the moment. But yeah, the gist of what he said is, look, what the U.S. just went through, I've seen it over and over. I've only ever seen it in emerging markets, and it's always the same problem. And I can tell you what the solution is, and I can tell you that, you know, if they don't implement the reforms that are part of the solution, in a period of time, the problem will return and it will be worse. And I hope that doesn't have to be the case. The name of the article was "The Quiet Coup."
Oh, yes.
In which he had this chief economist of the IMF say, yeah, you effectively had, a quiet coup where the banking system basically sort of directed a bailout for itself based on the close political ties and it has with Washington. And this was something that this economist referred to as something that is more typically seen in developing and emerging markets than in developed markets, which was his point. But yeah, I mean, it sort of dovetails with that, right? So you had commercial banks effectively forced via regulation to buy treasuries. That was effective QE. Roughly a year later, it was mandated by regulations that money market funds or MMFs. There was a reform of MMFs put in place whereby MMFs had to buy more treasuries. And so you had this big shift out of private sector short-term paper into short-term treasury paper. And that, too, over the span of about a 12-month time frame, amounted to $800, $900 billion, maybe even $1 trillion effectively of QE. It raised borrowing costs in the private sector. You can see LIBOR rose meaningfully in that time as a result. And sort of an emerging market playbook, find other private sector sources to fund the government. And the other playbook the U.S. ran at that time, it was explicitly designed this way or if it just happened to be coincidental, but the reality is it certainly was in effect. This was emerging markets have imbalance of payments problems. They force they try to force some of the biggest costs of government onto the citizens, either via tax increase or whatever the case may be. And in late 2014, we had Obamacare really go into effect, or ACA, and you saw premium increases and copay increases. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal at the time, which I highlighted in the past, where it said, one good thing about Obamacare is that it's reducing the U.S. deficit. And I remember saying to a friend of mine at the time, going, that's not what this was sold as.
No.
What are they? But that's what it did. And so, these measures, these were measures the U.S. took, and it made sense. They, it was effectively austerity measures, through the banking system, through MMFs, through ACA, to try to reduce U.S. dollar deficits in that time.
Well, it's coming from my perspective, it's been futile and it's been temporary. At best, because, and I know you've put out a lot of work on this and have talked about this, but, is there any way that these deficits don't explode over the next 3 years back up? I mean, the way I'm looking at it is I'm looking at trillion-dollar deficits sort of becoming the norm. Is that over the top, do you think, or is that realistic?
No, I think it's realistic. And, to your point, it was ultimately a futile effort because, the entitlement side, they've long talked about reforms. It's such a big number, and we're in sort of where we are demographically with the baby boom generation that you sort of can't get around it. And, these moves made sense. Basically the U.S. was trying to reduce deficits, and these measures make sense as long as your moves to reduce deficits don't negatively impact your economy to the point that you begin increasing deficits because you've slowed growth so much that your tax receipts begin falling, and critically, moves to reduce deficits began increasing deficits in the third quarter of 2016. And to me, when you ask, okay, where are we on this path? 3Q16 was a huge moment because that was the moment when the United States Congressional Budget Office came out and said, for the first time since 2009, the U.S. deficit as a percent of GDP is going to widen. And this was a huge moment. We wrote about it to our customers at the time. Deficits widening as a percent of GDP had only happened prior to that 7 times in the past 50 years.
Wow.
And in 6 of those 7 prior times, the U.S. economy was in recession 12 months later, roughly on average 12 months later. And the one time the U.S. economy didn't go into recession in those 7, the dollar was significantly devalued at the Plaza Accord. And so to us, it was like, okay, we're either going to have a recession. And if we have a recession with our current fiscal situation, you know, deficits, you know, $1 trillion deficits will be quaint. And our take was they're going to have to reduce the value of the dollar. And it was interesting, right about that time, you began seeing the stock market rally.
Yeah.
You know, 3Q16. And at first it was a, you know, hey, it's a Hillary rally. Hillary's going to win. And that's why the market's rallying. And then Hillary lost. And, you know, of course, we had like a 6-hour sell-off. And then it was a Trump rally. And then it was an infrastructure rally. And then it was a, you know.
Yeah, what is it now?
You know, the tax. I think all along it is. Exactly. And not sort of, you know, we have had some of these things happen now. But I think what it was the beginning of a realization by global markets. A real critical chart I think I've highlighted in the Macro Voices presentation, and certainly we've highlighted a number of times elsewhere, is if you look at the S&P 500 over the TLT, which is a long bond ETF, there was a clear breakout on a 25-year chart to all-time highs in, you know, shortly, right around 3Q16 or right after the election, which is basically a sign that, you know, you started to see the bond market flee into the stock market.
Right.
And I think that what we were seeing was, you know, to your earlier question, can we have risk off? You know, yes, but it can't last for very long. And so if you're running, you know, if you're a sovereign wealth fund running $100 billion, $200 billion, you know, you're sort of steering the Titanic from a money management perspective. You can't whip that kind of money in and out of markets. You're more in an asset allocation game. And so if once you saw 3Q16, when U.S. moves to reduce the deficit began increasing the deficit, you know, as long as global FX reserve balances, as long as central banks are not sterilizing U.S. deficits anymore, like the end game became very, very clear cut. You know, timing, you know, remained yet to be seen, but we were now, you know, that was a quickening. And so, you know, if I'm running $100 billion, $200 billion sovereign wealth fund, I look at what happened in 3Q16 with that widening of the deficit for only the 8th time in 50 years, and I go, all right, well, yeah, I could have one risk off if we have a recession, but it's got to be brief. And, you know, we know what, you know, after 08, we know what the Americans are going to do in the next recession. So instead of running a portfolio, you know, maybe I've got, you know, 60% in equities and 40% in bonds, I'm going to go 70% equities, 30% bonds, or maybe I'll go 80% equities, 20%. And I think that's what you began to see in 3Q16, 4Q16, and throughout 2017 was this realization that, you know, we were on the wrong side of this, you know, of these moves that trying to reduce deficits. We weren't going to be able to get out of it without reducing the value of the dollar.
Yeah. Yeah. And on that point, just to piggyback that, isn't, or at least the way that I've looked at it, and tell me where I'm wrong or where I'm right on this one, but isn't inflation where all this ends? I mean, if you know, we know how central banks fight deflation now, obviously, and we know how they fight inflation. The thing that I think is interesting is you have these, you know, you've got these loggerhead type situation where, yes, they want to, you know, accelerate growth. And obviously the Fed is dead set on raising rates. I don't know how much, you know, I'd love to know how much of that they really believed and how far, you know, how high they thought they'd be able to raise them. But isn't inflation where this whole thing breaks down? Because you can't build up this massive pile of debt, greater than the world's ever seen, at interest rates at 5,000-year lows. And then if inflation becomes a problem, you can't do what Volcker did. I mean, if you had a Volcker step in now, and it, you know, if inflation becomes a runaway issue, you know, you'd implode the whole system. Do you agree with that? Is inflation where this ends, or how will they combat inflation? How is that going to be dealt with?
I by and large, I completely agree. I think, you know, it's one of these, I think it ties in, you know, I think there's, you know, I've said to people, I think we will have inflation, but I think quote unquote inflation will remain below Fed expectations. And I think this is a, you know, the, you know, this is a challenge of where the Fed is. They've got this gigantic bond market that is very sensitive to interest rates and inflation. And so you can't be seen losing control. And so you need to sort of have reported inflation rates be very tame to kind of keep that bond market placated. You know, the fact that as we now come to find out, it should have been Trump versus Sanders, to me says a whole lot about sort of what's been happening to real living standards and the real levels of inflation. And so where I then tie that back to what does this mean for the economic side and how this ends to your question of inflation is, you know, and I think this also speaks to the, you know, 3Q16 where markets took off and particularly took off after Trump got elected was, you know, for a long, long time, we've had policymakers talking about reforming entitlements, right? Mm. Where, reform entitlements, entitlement reform. And I think, you know, a big message from Brexit and from Trump and, you know, coming so closely on the heels of one another was, I think the markets began to take a step back at that point and go, oh my God, they are not going to be able to reform any of these entitlements. It's the window for that being politically possible is now closed. They're going to have to print all of this. And so I think it speaks to your point that, you know, the only way out is inflation. And I think it'll be heavily asset price inflation. I think, right. You know, America is a very unique situation where at the right price of pretty much anything, we can produce a whole lot of pretty much anything. And I frequently point to, you know, the shale, U.S. shale oil as an example, right? The dollar, you know, from 2003 or 4 to 2008, the dollar collapsed against oil, right? We went from $20 or $30 a barrel to $150 a barrel. That's a collapse.
Yeah.
And, you know, 4 years later, we've got this booming shale sector. We're the biggest producer in the world. And I think that's very apropos. You know, it might not always be that simple in every supply chain, et cetera, but at the right price of oil, you know, we'll just produce it. So I don't think, you know, when you talk about the end game is inflation, absolutely. Is it, you know, I think the inflation levels and asset prices will be very, very, will continue to be high. And I think you'll see high inflation in other areas. But ultimately, based on how, you know, our broad and diverse economy, you know, I think at some level, those levels of inflation will be very stimulative to the U.S. economy.
So for those of you that had just joined us midway through this or just joined us recently, stick with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with Luke Grohman and continue our conversation about the dollar. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
I had never before worked with a financial advisor or endorsed a firm because I always saw the same cookie cutter stock bond split recommendation, bonds for safety. That's not helping right now. Hey, it's Story Monson. I love the way Zach Abraham and Bulwark Capital actively manage our portfolio instead of all the other guys that just have the ride it out mentality. Zach, you do it differently.
Yeah, Dory, we sure do. We take a risk management approach, meaning that we're constantly looking for ways to lower our clients' exposure to risk without giving up upside performance. The traditional stock bond portfolio absolutely will not deliver similar results to the past. You have to do things differently.
This is your retirement. Get a second opinion. Call now. Schedule a risk review. Get your free copy of Common Sense Investing, 866-779-RISK, 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com. Bulwark Capital Management, a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show. For those of you just joining us, we're with Luke Grohman, founder and CEO of Forest for the Trees Research, and you can go to his website at www.fftt-llc.com, and I'd encourage you to do it. It's something that I've started looking at. As a matter of fact, I'm going to talk to Luke about becoming a paying subscriber because I just think he's doing research and that their outfit is doing research you can't get anywhere else. And this kind of brings me to my next point that I want to discuss with you. And during that Macro Voices conversation, that incredible special that you guys had on the dollar, there was an interesting point that you got that you brought up that everybody, you know, brilliant guys on that phone call all the way around, but guys sort of looked past. And it's something, again, that I've kind of been toying with the idea of, which was you were talking about how easily And I put that term in quotations because there was some debate about that. But I thought I understood what you were talking about. But how easily you could switch due to this whole dollar shortage issue. And I would love to discuss that for a couple hours, but we've got, you know, we got to pick our spots. But the how easily we could switch to a gold-backed currency or something of this nature. And, you know, they talked about the mechanics of being able to do that. And I, if memory serves me correctly, you made a point sort of like, look, all you have to do is devalue dollar to the gold. For instance, you know, make like a pseudo new gold standard and say, look, you know, an ounce of gold is now worth $10,000 or $12,000. Can you give me, you know, tell me where I'm wrong on that one and clarify that point, because I thought it was a really salient point you put out there. And I also thought it was something that I think people need to be aware of, because I don't see something like this not taking place.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I think it's important that to high, you know, gold standard is another one of these words that gets people very, very, it's a very emotional topic.
Right, right.
I do not think we are going to go back on any sort of gold standard of direct convertibility,
right,
backing of the money supply by the dollar, et cetera. That said, what, you know, what I was referring to in that is effectively alleviating this dollar, global dollar shortage or safe asset shortage by raising the price of gold.
Right.
In other words, if you know, and it's interesting, Ken Rogoff, former IMF guy, well-known economist, wrote a really interesting piece in May of 2016 in I think Project Syndicate, where he said emerging markets should go for the gold. And he said, hey, there's this risk-free asset shortage, and, you know, all that they should, you know, one way to alleviate this would be as if emerging markets would take maybe 10% of their FX reserves and bid for gold. And because there's no upside limit on the price of gold, you know, it would increase the price of gold, and they own gold, the U.S. owns gold. And so there would be, you know, it would basically be sort of a gold QE, if you will, where you're basically raising the price of gold, creating dollars through gold appreciation. If you look where all the gold sits, it's on sort of, you know, central bank balance sheets around the world. Certain commercial banks in China own a lot of it. It would alleviate a lot of these liquidity problems. The issue is not mechanical. It could be done very easily with a few keystrokes. You know, gold wouldn't have to move. You wouldn't be on a gold standard. The issue is political, particularly political vis-a-vis the United States, because what you would be doing effectively would be creating a new neutral reserve asset that competes with U.S. Treasury bonds as the world's dominant reserve asset.
And Luke, I hate to quit. I hope you don't mind if I jump in and interrupt you. I want to make the most of our time. On that vein of what you're talking about, isn't that what needs to be done? If I'm sitting there and I'm Russia and China, for instance, I'm sitting there watching the fact that the United States gets away with this whole deficit debt debacle, and I'm sitting there, wouldn't it be in those countries? But I mean, how long are they going to keep playing the game? It seems to me that at some point they're going to say, no, we need a central asset, which all other currencies are, you know, measured against. We're not playing this U.S. dollar, you know, king dollar game anymore. It's too beneficial to you guys. It hamstrings us. It creates this dollar shortage issue that you talk about. These guys aren't going to put up with this much longer, are they?
No. And that's you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, look, as far back as early 2009, China started saying the dollar is the world's problem. The U.S., we need a neutral reserve asset. And they were really pushing for the IMF SDR at that point. And, of course, they got into the IMF SDR basket a couple years ago. World Bank chief economist talked about it. You had World Bank chief economist talk about it. You had the IMF in 2011 wrote a white paper talking about repricing oil and gold and certain other commodities in IMF SDRs, which would accomplish the exact same thing, where – suddenly you have this neutral reserve asset. That is absolutely the fix. There is no question that is the fix. And if gold was revalued higher by the IMF or by the BIS as a means of helping to create this neutral reserve asset, You know, generally speaking, Americans say, "Oh gosh, if gold is at $5,000 or $10,000, the world is, you know, it's going to be a zombie apocalypse, and all you're going to need is shotguns and spam." And if you actually look at the way the world is set up and the problem we're having, there is, you know, I would take the opposite tack. People will be amazed how fixed the world is at $5,000 or $10,000 gold. You will have recollateralized the system. You would have reliquified it.
Yep.
It would be subtle global trade imbalances that exist in a neutral asset. You would really usher in a new golden era of global trade. It would not be the end of globalism. It would just be goods for goods globalism instead of goods for IOUs or U.S. Treasuries globalism that we've had the last 40 years. But that is ultimately the political problem I refer to, which is that this would be a great, great thing for most of America. It would not be a great, great thing for Washington, D.C., who likes having a credit card that has no limit and can always be rolled over and, you know, has no impact on them. And that's the political problem at question. But very clearly, and we talked about this in our America Voices presentation, China, Russia, multilateral organizations all over the world are aware of the dollar's number one problem, and they are and have been for years actively taking aggressive, accelerating steps to move towards this neutral reserve asset settlement system.
And now all of these are the reasons why you coined the phrase, which I love, and I've absolutely stolen it from you. So just so you know, but you refer to gold as the credit default swap of this cycle. So I'm assuming, and I've listened to you talk, but just so everybody else can hear, I'm assuming you believe that there's an element of inevitability to all this, of gold taking more of a center stage position. Would I be correct?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair to say. You know, it's very clear emerging market parties and others, Europeans, are moving, gold is moving back into the system in some capacity.
Yeah. And from your perspective, you believe that it's got to be some part of the solution eventually, right?
It doesn't necessarily have to be, but if I look at all the parties to who this conversation, you know, would take place, right? So, if, you know, just look at the emerging market side of things, in particular, the creditors, right? So, you know, the Germans, the Chinese,
right?
To a certain extent, OPEC. They are going to want, you know, their interests are going to want to be represented by having some portion of a neutral reserve currency that maintains some level of reserve asset that maintains some level of purchasing power, right? That,
yeah.
That is, that seems to be, based on how they've been acting, when you look at the purchases of China, of gold by China, which have been enormous, in particular since 2011 and accelerated since 2013. If you look at Russia, who have been just buying gold every single month. If you look at Germany repatriating gold, if you look at Austria repatriating gold, if you look at the Dutch repatriating gold, you can see these movements of physical gold taking place all around the world, from creditor, by creditor nations, that would, seem to be indicative of a desire to, move gold back into the system as some sort of reference point role.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, I you've extended your time for us a little bit here today, and I can't thank you enough. I could literally sit there and throw these questions at you all day, just because I love the way you think about this and I love the research you've done. And for those of you that don't know, we've been joined by Luke Grohman here, the CEO of Forest for the Trees. Website is www.fftt-llc.com. I'd encourage you guys to go do what I do, which is make that one of your research points. As a matter of fact, I'm going to discuss signing up as a paying member of Forest for the Trees research, because I think, Luke, you guys are getting at the heart of the matter like few others out there. And I can't thank you enough for taking some time today and joining us.
Well, thank you for that compliment, and thank you for having me on the show. It's been real enjoyable to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully we can get you on again. And but thank you guys for joining. All right. Well, we're going to hold you to that. And we do that. You know, we get our favorite interview guys, and we just tell them, hey, look, you can't let the listeners down, man. You got to get back on here and give us the new spiel. So anyway.
Excellent.
Yeah, I appreciate you joining us. And one more time, Forest for the Trees, FFTT-LLC.com. Appreciate you guys listening today. And enjoy the rest of your weekend. Enjoyed putting the show on for you. And for those of you that just caught the tail end of it, we're going to have it up on our iTunes page here, I believe, by Monday, Darren. We should have it on there on Monday. Make sure you listen to this. Make sure you go to Macro Voices and listen to their special on the U.S. dollar. These are things everybody needs to know. Anyway, we got to run. We're out of time. Appreciate you listening. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.